Today on the 21st, we'll continue our discussion with different constituencies about what issues matter to them as Election Day approaches. Today, we're talking about the African-American vote, and we'll hear from three generations of Black activists, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr.
When we use the vote effectively, we can elect a Harold Washington. We can elect a Barack Obama. We can elect a woman to be president.
And as Jewish people around the world prepare for the High Holy Day of Yom Kippur, we speak with a Champaign rabbi about how the message of atonement and forgiveness has special resonance this year. And finally, one of the ways to fight the Zika virus is to kill the mosquitoes that spread it.
Compared to the number of other mosquito-borne diseases, it's still one of the viruses we know the least about.
We'll talk to an Illinois State University professor who's studying the most effective ways to kill disease-transmitting mosquitoes. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's an assumption that African Americans will always vote Democratic in elections. It's not completely unfounded. Data from the Pew Research Center shows that more than 80% of Black voters identify as Democrat. And in this election, support for Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is polling at between 2 and 6% nationwide. The Black vote, of course, is not as simple as that. Many Black people supported Bernie Sanders during the primary season, and there are some African Americans whose voting record doesn't line up with their personal beliefs. All this week, we're taking part in a nationwide conversation led by NPR called A Nation Engaged. This week, we're talking about what it means to be an American today. And today, we wanted to talk to Black voters from different generations across Illinois about what issues are important to them and whether their candidates are who the candidates they want to have as Election Day approaches. Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. is the founder and president of the Rainbow Push Coalition. He's a longtime civil rights activist, a former presidential candidate himself, and he joined us on the phone from St. Louis. We spoke with him yesterday afternoon while he was on a bus tour with the Democratic National Committee.
Well, thank you very much.
Reverend Jackson, I can't help but think about the op-ed that you wrote in the Sun-Times this past weekend, counting your blessings, turning 75, and sort of talking about where you feel, thinking of the course of your life and your role in the civil rights movement. I can't help but wonder where you think African-American voters are now in this 2016 election.
Well, in all of our struggles, the crown jewel of the struggle in democracy is the protected right to vote. For 246 years in slavery, we did not have the right to vote. 100 years in Jim Crow, we did not have the protected right to vote, regarding 1965. But not blacks only. Blacks got the right to vote in 65. White women got the right to serve on juries in the South. 18-year-olds were serving in Vietnam, could not vote. They got the right to vote. You could vote on campus for the first time and vote bilingually. But we've just basically had for 51 years the protected the right to vote. The Supreme Court passed a bill that opened the doors for various forms of voter restriction. And the appellate court had ruled that it showed patterns of racial discrimination and voter restrictions, stopping same-day registration, stopping Sunday voting, stopping early voting, making voting more difficult to get to. And the court ruled that that is a voter restriction. Trump said it is voter fraud, so that he takes lightly the easy access to voting. That's fundamental. The second issue is access to affordable health care. So fundamental. 20 million Americans have health insurance today. We did not have it 7 years ago. The third issue is affordable education. Student loan debt is greater than credit card debt. So Hillary's plan to make public free education and to renegotiate student loan debt is a big deal for so many young Americans moving into their independence. The ability to have gender and racial equality, given the disparities, and to have a clear alliance with our Mexican allies and to secure Mexican-Americans and to secure Muslim-Americans. After all, the idea of deporting 16 million people across the border is unthinkable, undoable, and unnecessary, and it says nothing about our future.
Reverend Jackson, we've also heard, I wonder, as you were talking about standing with the African-American community, standing with Mexican-Americans, standing with Islamic brothers and sisters, how do you feel about the tone of this campaign, the conversations, the rhetoric that we've heard? How do you feel like this has impacted civil rights, the conversations that we're having in this country right now?
The night President Obama won that day, the huge inaugural ceremonies, Republicans met that day to decide, how shall we defeat him? And if he say yay, they say nay. They covered the affordable health care vote for all Americans, and they are against it for the poorest Americans. It comes with a plan to bail out the automotive industry, which was about to go belly up. And we saved that industry as number one again. And even those who got the job, some of them were against that as well. And then up trumps the birth of Mugabe. Well, he was not born. He's not legitimate. And that failed. And that's the urban America policy is stopping risk of law and order. These movements have led to a lot of pain, a lot of unnecessary polarization. We have survived apart. We must now literally learn how to live together. If we can scream at football games on Saturday afternoon and Sunday, and have big fun at football games and fight wars together, we must learn to live and vote together to find our own interests. My interest really lies in the right to vote and health care that's affordable, and education and livable wages, and ending racial and gender disparities.
When we think about younger voters in the Black community, Reverend, I'm thinking about the level of excitement that we saw in Chicago for Barack Obama. I'm wondering what you think about young Black voters who've been so, the activists that we've seen, the young people who've led the Black Lives Matter movement. Do you feel that they are as actively tapped into this election as they have been in issues of racial injustice and police brutality?
Well, they must appreciate the relationship between racial injustice and lack of power. I said to a young man here in Ferguson, Missouri, and by the way, in the debate last night, my son is Ferguson, Missouri, never came up.
Yes. Was that a surprise to you that at a debate in St. Louis?
It was just astonishing. And so I said to him, let's register and vote and fight back. Let's fight pain with power. The one young man said, I'm not into voting. I'm not into that. I said, if you were in court the day that Michael Brown's killer came to court, you vote against him. Shall I vote against him? I'm not a punk. I said, I understand that. You understand, only those who are registered can serve on juries. He said, oh. He meant well. He was willing to die, but not to live for the proposition of freedom and justice. He just did not know. Voting matters. It determines the juries. It determines judges. It determines state attorneys and legislators and congresspeople. It determines laws under which we live. We live in our faith and in our beliefs. The law comes from politics. From womb, birth certificate, to death certificate, you're in the system, and therefore fight to determine its direction and its priorities is the power we have. If we use that vote effectively, when we use the vote effectively, we can elect a Harold Washington, we can elect a Barack Obama, or we can elect a woman to be president. We use that vote effectively, and those elections are meaningful because they determine who will determine what priorities are. So Neil says, I want a Supreme Court that will be sensitive to women's reproductive rights, a Supreme Court that would be sensitive to racial justice. In some sense, I want Justice Scalia, who is leader for women's reproductive rights, now for racial equality. Those are big decisions. That's not just a this election deal. Those are life-term deals.
Reverend, when you say that voting matters, do you feel like, what do you say to African Americans who say they're not going to vote because they don't like either candidate? Do you think that we're going to see enough sufficient turnout among the African American community?
When the Democrats say we must stand to live a wage, increasing those who work at fast food restaurants and those who do day labor and those who do temporary labor to get livable wages, and some says the wage is too high. That's, livable wages is a reason to vote. And he says the first thing he'll kill will be affordable health care. For the poorest people, that matters to their lives. He says there's too much violence in the ghetto. But then he won't vet the access to guns, not ban assault weapons. So if you're against violence, ban assault weapons, which are so strong and so powerful, you should not defend themselves nor the public against them. Those are Democratic principles. I thought Trump said something that was very disturbing. I thought got missed in the mix. One, if I'm elected, I'll have you sent to jail. In the most brutal of third world countries, the president can lock up the opposition. No one should have that kind of power in the government of checks and balances.
What did you think about Donald Trump's comments that he's made, both in the past about Chicago as well as about African-American neighborhoods?
He's right, but for the wrong reasons. You know, Brooke Clark is right twice today. His observation is correct, but he offers no recommendation. For example, in these urban centers, drugs and guns and jobs out is a lethal combination. He has no plan to stop to break up that cycle. On the other hand, if that were a priority of reinvesting in America, if you just remove, let's say Chicago, or St. Louis, to remove lead paint jobs, to cut down the growing grass and jobs for the landscapers, to tear down those hollow houses, to demolish those that cannot be rebuilt. Where you have all the boards, put in window panes and roofs and glazes. That may be more jobs than people. If our priority is healing at home and not killing abroad, then if there's any music Trump wants to hear, is that it is blacks decide not to vote. What music that would be to his ears, and how sad it would be. If you make a decision, you've chosen the wrong side of history.
Reverend Jackson, we're taking part in a nationwide conversation that NPR stations are having this week about what it means to be an American today. And I wonder if I could ask the question to you, what you think it means to be a black voter in this country today. What issues would you like to see addressed that haven't been? What issues do you think need to be, are the most important?
Well, racial disparities are real, and gender disparities are real. And the question is, do you have a weapon with which to protect your interest in those struggles? When Fred Hampton was killed in Chicago in 1969, we voted the state to turn out of office who was a part of the killing. When Laquan McDonald was killed in Chicago, and 14 months of tapes were withheld by the state attorney, we voted her out of office and voted someone else in. We didn't get the person out of office just by cursing or praying, but by praying and marching and voting. All that made it happen. So use all these weapons to make things happen. And the reason why we got an African-American running for Secretary of State in California, or Congress in Delaware, the President of the United States, all of this is post-1965. With the right to vote comes the capacity to build coalitions and to change the course of the country.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. joining us from a bus tour he's doing right now of St. Louis with the Democratic National Committee. Thank you so much for joining us, Reverend, and happy birthday again.
Thank you. Well, let me say to those who want to support what we're doing, if you would text KLJ75 to 41444, you can be in touch with what we're doing. Text KLJ75 to 41444 to help us very much.
We're joined now by State Representative Carol Ammon. She represents the 103rd District, which comprises most of Champaign and Urbana. And she's on the phone with us from around town, Champaign, Urbana. She's moving from one event to the other today. Representative Ammons, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciated the last segment.
Thank you. You know, you've been in the state legislature for a couple of years now, and I really appreciated the idea of having three different generations of activists and politicians to talk about where black voters are standing in Illinois right now. But I wonder, as someone who's held office for a couple of years now, how do you see this election shaping out? Are you seeing issues that you think are important to the community throughout Illinois and not just, for example, the black community in Chicago? Are you seeing that being addressed?
Well, I think that there is definitely a desire for economic security in communities. I think what Reverend Jackson just so eloquently pointed out is you can't have communities flooded with guns, flooded with drugs, and no jobs, no opportunities, no training, and think you're going to have a safe community and a safe state. And so for us, we really want to highlight the need for folks to vote, because the person who's going to make the decision as to where the resources go in your community will be the person who is going to be on that ballot. And you have to be clear on who you're selecting come this November and what they stand for. So voting matters. And I just left a church meeting with local pastors. They are all engaged and very concerned about making sure that not only people have the right to vote, but that they understand what they are voting for. What are the issues that matter to them, and how do they translate that through their vote?
What do you think the most important issues are that matter? What were you hearing from these ministers?
I think what we hear mostly is a lot of about educational training and opportunities. A lot of the parishioners, their parents are concerned about not having access to MAP grants and funding in our community. That's a big issue, as well as issues around criminal justice reform, work that I've been doing since I entered the legislature and before. Those are some of the main issues that I've talked to pastors about in the last several weeks that's important in this election.
Now, Representative Ammons, you originally were campaigning for Bernie Sanders. What made you want to support him in the first place?
I think the issues that Bernie Sanders stands for, again, the issue of access to education for all Americans, that is a huge priority when I talk to people across generational lines. They want their children to have a better future. And that has taken center stage when it comes to the most important issues in the House. I have a student in college, so I'm concerned about that issue. But we also know that people are really concerned about the security and the future of our country. And what we see on the national horizon really makes people question that in this presidential election, and the outcome of this election is going to matter the most to people on the ground.
Representative Ammons, we just have about 30 seconds left, but just wanted to ask you about why you think it's important to be voting in November, who you're going to be voting for. I assume that's going to be Hillary Clinton.
Well, certainly I'm supporting the Democratic nominee. I'm supporting Hillary Clinton, and I'm also encouraging people to support Democratic candidates up and down the ballot. This is important. The GOP in Illinois is spending millions of dollars currently to take away same-day voting registration in the state of Illinois, mostly affecting urban areas, minority communities, and students. We don't want to see the rolling back of the hands of time. So voting is a critical matter today. Voter suppression is on the horizon, and we want to eliminate that. We also want people to know that we're hosting Souls to the Polls on November 6th from 1 to 4. Lunch will be served. People to get out and vote. No excuses whatsoever come this November.
Thanks for that, Representative Ammons. We'll find that information and tweet it out if you follow 21st Show, Representative Carol Ammons. Stay tuned. You're listening to 21st. We'll have a college student up next. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking to Black voters across Illinois. We're talking to different generations of African Americans. We were just speaking with the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Representative Carol Ammons, and she mentioned having a suit in college, and we wanted to have a college voice in this conversation. So I want to introduce Manny Campbell. He's a senior. He's studying financial planning at the University of Illinois. He's also a young activist who favors peaceful protest and co-chair of the 100 Strong program. That program connects Black students with academic career and cultural opportunities to keep Black students enrolled at the University of Illinois. Manny, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. How are you guys doing this morning?
Good. Thank you. Now, we're listening and we're just thinking Reverend Jackson just turned 75 this past weekend. It was interesting to hear him discussing sort of the history of the movement. Of course, his longtime involvement in the civil rights movement. You're 21. I wanted to ask what you think it means to be a young Black American man today.
Personally, referring to Langston Hughes, I Too, the poem, you may be familiar with it. I'm the darker brother and I too am America. And I resonate with that poem not only because I am African-American, but people don't really understand what it may mean by that poem. And being African-American in the United States today, I can be a University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign student and even a graduate, but still be looked at as a lesser individual. And I can be doing the same exact thing as my white counterparts, but I may be kind of slighted in my view in terms of society. People will look at me completely different. I can still have a suit and tie on, but they'll still see my Black skin.
Manny, do you think the presidential candidates get that?
I really do not believe they do. And this is not to come at either candidate, but it's more so to try to educate the individuals who are voting for these candidates. They don't seem to understand what it means to be Black in the United States, and obviously because they aren't Black, but more so because when we're addressing these topics, and even University of Illinois students were protesting, or people protesting in Chicago, Baton Rouge, different areas of the United States, we feel like we're not being heard. And that's the main problem I see with this these two candidates this year. And it seems as though we're going unheard. And that's the main reason why voters, even Black voters, may not be interested in the candidates this year. And that's the big problem, because I know for myself, I'm going to be voting. And it's just saddening to hear that individuals are just not voting because, oh, neither candidate suits me. And I can understand where they're coming from. However, that's not the way we should look at it, because a no vote is also a vote as well. And that is impacting this presidential candidacy.
Manny, you work with the 100 Black, you have the 100 Strong program at the University of Illinois. You've also been involved in lots of different peaceful protests for especially the past year. What kind of issues have you been mostly focusing your protesting on?
Mainly police brutality, as well as the affordable education for African-American students, minorities in general, and cutting down on tuition payments. But I want to kind of touch on police brutality, and not only because it's very personal to me, but people may not understand the impact of what goes on in the streets or in a protest. Peaceful protesting, it starts off peaceful and we keep it that way, but it's on the other side where police officers may antagonize and pester the protesters to the point where, hey, we're fed up. I personally, I'm respectful. I thank my mother for that to this day. I'm the one who's on the front lines asking questions to the police officers. I'm not trying to get in the way. I'm not trying to fight. I'm not trying to start a riot. However, I do see why people end up in these situations where you see in Chicago, even on July 9th, 2016, where there was 19 individuals arrested, you see that there's so much tension because we feel like we're still not being heard. We could be literally in front of you and literally yelling to you or even having a regular conversation. You just won't hear us. We're going to be dismissed at the end of the day. It's just another black man who seems angry. Oh, we don't have to worry about them because we'll have another black man arrested the next day. So that's how it feels when we're talking about protesting or trying to at least get our voice heard.
Do you think that people who are protesting alongside you are as engaged in this election? Earlier we're hearing from Representative Ammons talking about that.
As far as the people protesting, those are the individuals who are actually invested in something. They're going to be there for a reason. The people that aren't at the protests, that's somebody and the people that we need to reach out to make sure that they're aware of what we're voting for, aware of what we need to vote for. And the people at the protest, I'm not really worried about them because I feel like they're a little bit more conscious and aware and ready to take action and use their vote and use their actual right to vote. And I'm glad that Reverend Jackson actually touched on where we came from in terms of not having the right to vote. Then now to this time, and it's saddening to hear again that people aren't taking the time or the understanding to why they need to vote. And I feel like the people at the protest, yes, they are aware and a little bit more active in terms of general society.
Right, the connections that he made, voting allows you to sit on a jury. Voting is what, you know, there were a lot of activists who took up the case of Anita Alvarez in her election with the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago. Do you feel that folks that you are protesting alongside are devoting the same amount of energy to protest as they are to this election?
Not necessarily from the protest to the election. I feel like there's a little bit more strain, a little bit more push for protest and getting our voices heard, because in terms of the election, we feel like the two candidates as well as some of the representatives, they're not really aligning with us. And that's a really big problem, because if I'm voting for someone, I want to know what you can do for me. That's the voter's perspective. And if the candidate cannot relate or give me a reason why I should vote for them, that's why people and students around the University of Illinois or even just around the United States aren't really involved or not invested in this actual election, because what are you going to do for me as a student? Are you going to help me with my tuition? No, you're not. You don't care about me. That's what a lot of people feel like. So that's why you see or hear people saying, oh, I'm not even going to vote this year. Oh, it's Trump or Hillary. So it's the lesser of two evils. I'm picking a double-edged sword.
Manny, what misconceptions do you think people have about young black voters?
I feel that the misconception is that we're not educated about who we're voting for or what we're voting for. I know personally I am, as well as multiple people that I associate with, and it's just a fallacy that African-American students or African-Americans in general aren't educated. We're just not aligning with the views or the lack thereof from these candidates. And it's just that's the main reason why you saw so many more voters voting for Barack Obama. You could relate with him, as well as there were certain individuals or certain topics that he could actually attack and actually get out of the way for African Americans. And it seems that although Hillary Clinton has actually given a plan for tuition and to cut down on that,
she's the whole tuition free plan.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Donald Trump also agrees that tuition should go down, but he doesn't even have a plan. So that's where the disconnect is, and why you see this misconception with African American students or African Americans in general for voting. We are educated, but we just don't we don't see these candidates as ready or fit for office.
That said, you are going to be voting.
Indeed, always.
Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. Manny Campbell is a senior at the U of I studying financial planning and agriculture,
indeed.
Right? Thanks, Manny.
All right. You guys have a great morning.
At sundown this evening, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar begins with Yom Kippur. We wanted to hear more about the religious holiday and how its message is resonating this year. So we're joined in studio now by Rabbi Alan Cook from the Reform Congregation at Sinai Temple in Champaign. Rabbi Alan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. So honored to be here again.
Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. I wonder if you can explain what that means, especially this year, what you think the primary messages are that you've been thinking about as you're preparing for the holiday.
Certainly. Yom Kippur comes 10 days after we celebrate our Jewish New Year, and the Jewish calendar being a lunar calendar, that date will vary from year to year. So we take the time on Yom Kippur to do some self-reflection and to think about what do we need to improve and how do we need to make amends with other people that we may have wronged either purposely or inadvertently, and how can we ask forgiveness from them? How can we ask forgiveness from God? And sometimes how can we ask forgiveness for forgiveness from ourselves.
Mm. When we think about this past year and we think about so much of the tumult that we've seen, not just in this country, but across the world, whether we're talking about things that have happened during the election or police shootings, we've seen terrorist attacks all over. Why do you think that's so important for people to take time to do what you're going to be doing for the next 24 hours?
Sure. So in Judaism, we call it teshuvah. Literally, it means an act of return, an act of coming back to the proper path. And it has to do a lot with reconciliation. Our tradition teaches that Yom Kippur is not effective in your relationship between yourself and God if you haven't first made the effort to repair the relationship between you and the other people in your life. And I think we need to think a lot these days about reconciliation. How do we bring these disparate groups, disparate opinions that have arisen, as you mentioned, in the police shootings, in racial tensions, in all of the tensions that have been exacerbated by this election? How do we reconcile? How do we bring people back together? And I think that there are moments in each major religion, including Judaism, where we try to take that opportunity for reflection and for building reconciliation.
Another rabbi I was reading an op-ed in the Washington Post that he published today, Rabbi Jonah Pressner, and he was talking about how Jewish Americans have transitioned in part from being a very discriminated against group to having a little bit more representation and power. And he said, refusing to acknowledge the role that our predominant whiteness plays in this transition requires willful blindness. And on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, we must ask, how have we arranged our lives in ways that allow us to ignore the sufferings of other Americans? And obviously, a lot of what you're talking about is self-reflection, which is important. But do you also tell your congregation to be thinking about the trials and tribulations of people who are other than them?
Of course. I think we're not homogenous in whiteness. Even in a small community like Champaign, our congregation has Jews of color. We have LGBTQ Jews. We have Jews from a variety of different backgrounds. But I really liked Rabbi Pesner's message. I'm pleased to call him a colleague and a friend. And I think that he gives an important reminder to us that we need to be concerned about the needs of others and the hurts of others. There's a classic traditional story of two students studying with a rabbi, and the rabbi turns to one student and says, Shlomo, do you love Moshe? And Shlomo says, well, of course I do. I've been studying with him for years and years and years. He's one of my best friends. And the rabbi says, well, if you really love him, tell me what makes him hurt. And Shlomo is astonished that this friend that he feels that he knew really well, he is missing that ingredient in their relationship because he doesn't know really what makes his friend hurt. And in order to know what makes one another tick, we have to be attuned to one to each other's pain, hopefully attuned to each other's celebrations also. But we have to reach out and form community. I'm speaking in my messages over the next couple of days to my congregation about the strength of our community as a congregation. But I also use that hopefully to paint with a wider brush our need to be involved in the broader community here in Champaign and throughout the world.
Last time you were on the 21st, you were on the program, Rabbi. We were sitting with people of different faiths. Your congregation has been taking part in an interfaith Habitat for Humanity build. And I know as it's in the interfaith dialogue is something that's really important to you. And I wonder how you think people of other faiths can think about using this time as well, maybe for some self-reflection, even if they're not Jewish.
Sure. You know, even if this is not a date that is prescribed for you on your calendar for self-reflection and atonement, I think that this is a season as we build up towards the election, as we've seen so much tension in our country and in our community, that we can all always benefit from a moment of taking a step back and looking in the mirror and reflecting on who we are and who we want to be. And as I mentioned during my last appearance, with my colleagues, Pastor Michael Crosby from First Mennonite and Imam Usman Sawadogo from CIMIC, from Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, you know, we have been blessed to be able to look at one another and with our other colleagues in interfaith and to try to put aside differences and look at what the essential humanity is on the inside. And if we can get away from that sense of otherness and build towards collaboration and cooperativeness, whether it's on Yom Kippur, whether it's on Easter, whether it's on Christmas, whether it's on Ramadan, whatever day of the year it happens to be, even if it's not a particularly holy day, then we can build towards reconciliation, and I think we can make the world a better place.
When we think about that concept of return, I wonder if we think about how you're thinking about sort of doing that over the next 24 hours or the next 48 hours, because I know you have services that go on past sundown tomorrow evening.
For Jewish tradition says that this is the day on which we are to afflict ourselves. And so many people will enact that through fasting. But however we afflict ourselves, whether it is an act of as I said, fasting or abstaining from drink or abstaining from other things that we enjoy, whether it's the fact that people who come tonight aren't going to be able to watch the Cubs game, whether it's the fact that we are being more attuned to the hurt of others by not focusing on what's my next meal going to look like and so forth. I think any of those ways can help us tune in to the meaning of this day. We are very proud that as part of this day, when so many of the congregants are abstaining from eating food, that we ask them to take food from their pantry that they would otherwise be eating, and they bring it to the congregation to donate it, and we have a huge drive at this time of year for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So we're glad to be able to give back to the community beyond our personal religious expression.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I know it's a really busy time for you. Rabbi Alan Cook is the rabbi at Sinai Temple in Champaign. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Earlier this year, news of the Zika virus was all over media as the virus spread from South America to Central America and the Caribbean, later reaching Florida and most recently parts of Southeast Asia. We are still hearing about cases of local transmission of Zika in all of those areas, making the issue of how to combat the virus a serious one. One of the ways to fight it is to kill the mosquitoes that spread the virus, and a research team at Illinois State University has just received a grant of more than $400,000 from the National Institutes of Health to figure out how just to do that. that. We're joined now by Stephen Giuliano. He's a professor of ecology at Illinois State University. He's on the line with us from Normal. Stephen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, and thank you.
I wanted to hear more about the new study that just got funded in a minute, but first, I wonder if you can give us a sense of where we're at worldwide in our battle against the Zika virus. It seems like the news coverage has waned somewhat. Are we getting better at battling this virus?
It's an excellent question. I don't have the confidence to say that the answer to that question is yes. There is certainly a great deal of effort being put into understanding the virus and understanding its transmission by mosquitoes in various parts of the world and what can be done to limit it. But compared to the number of other mosquito-borne diseases, it's still one of the viruses we know the least about.
What question specifically are you hoping to address in the three-year study that you just received funding for?
Well, our work is on the ecology of the mosquitoes that transmit a number of different viruses to humans, not just on Zika or the mosquito that carries Zika. So what we're interested in is in the biology of larval mosquitoes. They often occur in aquatic environments where they're very crowded, many larvae in relatively small area. And what this means is that those larvae are suffering from lack of food, lack of other resources. And that has some interesting consequences if humans intervene to try and reduce the number of larvae. So attempts to control mosquitoes by attacking the larval stages, which is a very common thing that is done. And one of the consequences of that can be that if you only kill a certain fraction of the larvae in a given population, you may actually make the growth conditions better for the survivors so that those that are lucky enough not to be killed by the human intervention may be much better off and may have higher survival. And this can result, under some circumstances, in kind of paradoxical situation where you attempt to kill some fraction of the larvae, succeed in killing them, yet you get more adult mosquitoes, which is the disease-carrying stage, out of that aquatic environment.
How is that? Yeah, how can that happen? Because I think you would think if you kill off, why is it that by killing off, it is a bizarre unintended consequence,
it's
right?
It's an unintended consequence, and it happens because by thinning out the population, the survivors benefit by having more resources, particularly food. They grow faster, they grow bigger, they may have higher survival rate. What often happens when mosquito populations are quite crowded is that a very large number of them would die due to that crowding and low food, regardless of what you did. By thinning them out, you relieve that pressure on the population, and it can result in that paradoxical increase in the production of adults. And exactly what we're trying to do in the grant is to get a better idea of the conditions under which that can occur, first. Second, how different species may differ in their responses to added mortality. And third, how likely it is that those conditions that produce this paradoxical effect occur in nature, how widespread those conditions might be. So it's the kind of question that really goes to basic ecology of the larval stages of these mosquitoes, but it has, we think, kind of important consequences for how you might go about attempting to control mosquitoes if you're going to target the larval population. Did that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it's so interesting, Stephen, because I think that when we think about how, and I'm thinking in particular of my hometown of Miami, how they're trying to combat the Zika transmission or Zika spread now is very much a case of trying to make sure this is kind of traditional mosquito population control, which is telling residents to make sure you don't have standing water.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that – are you saying that it's – do we know that that necessarily works
now,
or doesn't work?
You have to distinguish between two ways you might try and reduce mosquito population. So you're talking about Miami. Envision a suburban area or an urban area like Miami where there are in people's backyards, let's say, flower pots or old tires or anything that would hold water, okay? Individual containers that hold water. there are two things you might do. One might be you would try and get people to empty out those containers and completely eradicate the water-holding vessels where these mosquitoes develop. That's unlikely to have any of these effects. What's more likely to have these effects would be, let's say, if you asked people to do something that would try and kill off the larvae in a particular container. So, for example, a lot of people in Illinois, for one place, keep rain barrels where they collect water as it comes off their roof, and they use that water to put on their garden. That can be a place where these mosquitoes would grow and develop as larvae. If you tried to add something to that water, let's say a pesticide, or another thing you might add would be a natural enemy to that water-holding container, that would have the potential to kill mosquitoes, but it might not kill every single one in the container. And that's more the situation that we're looking at with the grant, is where you're doing things that are reducing the number of larvae in a container, but maybe not killing every single one.
If you
did what you're talking about, and that is find every mosquito-holding container, dump out the water, the mosquitoes in that container would all be killed. That's unlikely to produce this effect. This is very much a phenomenon that occurs when there is partial mortality of the individuals in one body of water.
I see. And so do we know what are the most effective methods for reducing mosquito populations? Do we have a sense of that?
In my opinion, one of the most effective ways of approaching mosquito control is exactly what you are describing, and that is what's known in the jargon of mosquito control as source reduction. Trying to find the water-holding vessels that are the sources of mosquitoes and making sure that they don't hold water, and eliminating them in that way. That's probably one of the most effective, because when you do that, you kill every mosquito that's in that container. The problem is, for a lot of these mosquitoes that are the major vectors of things like Zika and dengue and other viruses, those containers are small, widely scattered, and hard to find. And so it's very difficult to find every single container.
Right. It's interesting, because I know that's always the message in South Florida is
get rid of any.
Everyone kind of knows, like, keep flower pots, all those things sort of overturned.
And part of the reason that's always the message is that's one of the strategies that, when it's implemented well, it really does work to reduce the number of mosquitoes.
Stephen, when we think about this, I'm speaking with Stephen Giuliano. He's a professor of ecology at ISU in Normal, and we're talking about a grant he just received from the National Institutes of Health to eliminate the mosquito population. And, of course, this is because of the mosquito-borne illnesses we've been hearing about so much this year, not just Zika, but dengue, West Nile. And I wonder, when we think about the thousands of different mosquito species in the world, why is it important, when we're talking about reducing mosquito populations, to take into account the species?
Well, not every mosquito is a threat. Some of them are completely benign as far as people are concerned, and they don't bother us. We don't bother them for the most part. There are a number of species that bite only birds, a number of species that bite only reptiles, for instance, and some that humans rarely encounter, and some that are just not very good at transmitting viruses. There are a few species, actually a really limited number, that are exceptionally important, and that's the target species for the grant-funded work that we are just beginning. Some of the major vectors turn out to be a set of these species that occur in man-made containers like flower pots and old tires, cemetery vases. And that's important because it also tends to put those species near where humans live, and so they have a lot of human mosquito contact. The other thing about those species is lots of them are non-native species that have been introduced by human activities across the world. The most prominent one is the one that is thought of as the major vector of Zika. All the data suggest it's the most important vector of Zika, and that's a species called Aedes aegypti, or the yellow fever mosquito. And as the name might indicate, it's an important vector of other things. It was the most prominent vector of yellow fever historically. It is also the major vector worldwide of dengue, and it is not coincidentally, but part of the reason it's such a good vector is It does really well in human-dominated habitats. It sometimes, in some places, spends most of its life living indoors in water-holding vessels that are inside houses, does most of its biting indoors, does most of its egg-laying indoors. You get the impression that it's a very close associate of human beings, and that is another reason why this mosquito is such a threat, is it is in close contact with us and therefore really good from the virus's point of view as a vehicle to get from one human host to another. So targeting all mosquitoes, if you want to think of it this way, would be kind of a waste of effort.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, why not just eliminate all of them? Do they? Yeah. That's what I would say. Like, yeah. Why not just eliminate all of them? Do they serve an ecological purpose?
There are, of course, mosquitoes that are important in a number of ecological systems where they are important food for other organisms, have important roles in aquatic habitats. But a more practical argument for why you would not wish to target all mosquitoes is it would be an incredible waste of your effort. There are a few of these species that are very, very important as disease vectors and others that are unimportant. Why spend valuable money, effort, and manpower on eliminating species that are no harm to human beings? You want to target the really dangerous ones.
Stephen, my last question for you. We just have a minute or two left. Part of the study will be conducted here in central Illinois. What are you planning to do?
Well, in central Illinois, we're planning on working mostly with the species of mosquitoes that are common here and potentially very important as disease vectors. That includes Culex pipiens, which is the major vector of West Nile virus. It includes Aedes albopictus, which goes by the common name of Asian tiger mosquito. It is an important vector of several different viruses, including dengue in some locations, including La Crosse encephalitis in some locations. It can be a vector of Zika, although it so far does not seem to be all that important. And we're also targeting another species that's common in central Illinois, that's eastern treehole mosquito, that carries La Crosse encephalitis. These species, what we wish to know about them is, number one, how their populations respond to different amounts of mortality imposed on the larvae, and mortality imposed on the larvae with different timings relative to their life cycle. So if you kill them when they're very young, is that better, worse, or just the same as killing them off when they're closer to maturity? That's one of the questions we want to get an answer for. And then the other thing we're going to try and do in central Illinois is some field experiments where we're going to try and get at how likely are the conditions that would lead to this effect that I mentioned earlier, where you kill some fraction of the population as larvae and the production of adults either stays the same or goes up. And so by answering those questions, we hope that we'll provide information that might help to guide people who are doing mosquito control in a couple ways. One would be what methods of mosquito control might be most effective based on what we know about the biology of these individual species. And number two, what would be the most effective time to target populations of larvae?
Quick question for you. Are you one of those people? I'm one of those people that always gets bit by mosquitoes. I imagine in your line of work that would be an occupational hazard.
I get bit all the time.
That's
whenever
unfortunate.
We're out in the field, we get bit by mosquitoes. It's one of the things we're going to places where they're common when we're in doing field work. And so we have to take some precautions to avoid getting bitten because we get so many bites. But yeah, I get my fair share.
Stephen Giuliano is a professor of ecology at Illinois State University, joining us from Normal. Thanks, Stephen.
All right. Thanks.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, our Nation Engage conversation continues as we look at why early voting is so important for people with disabilities. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us is on our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kisabika, Sean Newman, and Hal Ladelahi. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.